Okay.
Shop Talk Show.
You're listening to the Shop Talk Show. Yes, you are.
Freestyle.
Yeah, I wish I had freestyle rap skills, or I would have brought them out right now. Hello, welcome to the 11th. I've lost count. 11th episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, a podcast mostly about front end web design development, all of that stuff. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is my co-host Chris Coyer. Chris,
howdy, folks.
And Chris, do you want to introduce our special guest today?
We have a designer extraordinaire, front end superhero. Oh, geez, so many things. Just an incredible guest today. Gina Bolton joins us.
Thanks. Hi.
Yes.
This is
a good one. We're all big fans of Gina, as I'm sure you are. But just in case, we better go over it just a little bit. Could you give us the mini Gina blurb on who you are, what you're doing right now?
Yeah, sure. Gina, give us your elevator pitch here. The Gina Bolton elevator pitch.
I'm a product designer for Do, which is a social productivity app for your team. I also, when I have the spare time, I work on Art My Coffee, which has not been recently because I haven't had much spare time lately. But
yeah, that's a pretty sweet site, right? It's designs that like baristas like carve into the top of foam as they serve it to you, right?
Yeah, and sometimes they use syrups and other fun things to make art. But so that's one of my side projects. And most recently volunteered to help out with the SAS website redesign along with another group of really talented people. So pretty excited about that.
That is going to be sweet. So that is SAS-lang.com, right? That
one? Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. So it's going to be, have you like identified some goals for it and stuff? Is it going to be to teach it better? Or,
we have a lot of goals for it, but mostly just make it awesome.
Right.
Yeah. We have a lot of people that, a lot of people judge, certain types of tools simply based on the website. And we want to,
their decision based on how sweet the website is.
Just meaning like some people will turn away from something depending on how the site looks, so we just want to avoid that.
Sure. Yeah. I'd have to say if I had no idea what preprocessors were and somebody showed me two side by side slides of lesscss.org and SAS-lang, I'd probably the less one is a little nicer. So I'm glad you're in it because I prefer SAS. So I would I'm super glad that somebody as talented as you is going to head up this. You are heading it up, right? Is that the can I say that, or is it a team effort?
Yeah, it's a team effort, but I'm kind of leading it, so it's going to be awesome.
Really will. I am stuck with that.
Is the new site going to lose the lady on the phone?
That's up for discussion.
Up for discussion. Okay. Yeah. Very exciting. Very exciting.
I had a comment on a blog post on CSS tricks of somebody that was highly offended by the woman on the phone. Okay. Not that we're going to go there, but they were. I always thought that so bizarre. Like, really, it's just an old-timey illustration. I can't. The things people choose to get offended about is just bizarre to me. Even though we're going to skip most of that this week, we're going to talk about. So we have some news and links. Unless Dave, do you have anything to?
Oh, no, I got nothing. Okay. Go ahead.
We have a bunch of stuff to. We like to do mostly question and answer on here, but this week we have some fun links to share that are definitely worth talking about, and some a little bit of random drama. So one of the ones I put in here, a guy named Bill Hernandez wrote into us, and he was like, and it was kind of an email that we honestly get a lot of, and feel free to keep sending them. That's okay. It's kind of one of our repeat questions. It's like HTML5 and CSS, can we use them on our projects or not? Or what, it's kind of one of those questions, which we've, definitely covered in previous episodes. So check our archives. And he's like, well, certainly everyone must be using the Magento boilerplate, right? Because it solves a lot of those cross-browser issues. And I was like, Magento boilerplate? That's random. Have you guys heard of Magento? It's like an e-commerce platform.
Yeah, right? I'm familiar.
It's like, I don't know, like WordPress for selling stuff or whatever. Anyway, I just found it interesting that he just like assumed that the world makes e-commerce sites and thus, of course, we should be using the is it Magento, right? I always call it Magneto, which is definitely not what it's called.
Anyway, that was a missed branding opportunity there.
Yeah, perhaps Magento. It is, you know, so everybody's heard of like HTML5 boilerplate and stuff like that. It takes that and some other things and squishes them together to give you a boilerplate theme for Magento. So there's certainly like reset themes for WordPress and reset themes for all kinds of other CMSs. This is one that I just hadn't seen before for Magento. So people work on e-commerce a lot and use that, which a lot of people do. It's a really large platform. Check it out. I'll throw a link to it in the show notes. So the Magento boilerplate. I have another one that I want to mention too, which is Scott Jelt, who is of the Filament Group, made a polyfill. Scott has made other polyfills. One of them he made was respond.js. If you've seen that one, right? That like makes media queries work in like IE7 and 8 and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He made one for the picture element, which isn't a real element. So, you know, like image is not like bracket image source and stuff. He thinks that picture would be a cool replacement for image. And within the picture tag, you have different sources. Like you can have a video tag, and in the video, you have different sources that are like, here's the MP4 version and here's the AUG version or whatever. And depending on the browser years in support for that format, it will show the proper one. Well, he thinks picture would be cool, only it would be like, are you on a device whose screen is small? Then only serve up an image that is like appropriate for that smaller screen. So you have different sources in there for different screen sizes. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it solves that problem of being worried about serving too large of images when you're designing responsively. And I thought it would be interesting to bring up because hear what you guys think about that, because it's like, well, now you're inventing syntax. He's, you know, like picture is not standardized in any way. Nobody's really decided for sure that's going to be spec'd out and that's going to be moved forward the standards way. So is Scott premature in doing this? And are we worried that people are going to start using the picture element and then the standards body is going to pick something else? How do we feel about that?
I'm just happy they've taken the route that is going through the CSS working group the HTML? Yeah. But they're like taking the proper route to get something built into a spec that can be then voted on or implemented. And then they have a working prototype of how, hey, this would be useful. So, I kind of have a super crush on Scott from Filament Group right now. So he can do no wrong in my eyes.
Just a quick, super quick follow-ups on the, like in a really early episode, we talked about tracking your print style sheets. Like how could you find out on a website how many times it's been printed in a given period of time? And then I forget his name, but one of our readers put together this thing that had like, you just set the background image to something in your CSS that's only gets called in your print style sheet, but that image is really a PHP script, and that PHP script like just runs a little incrementer so you can see how many times that image was requested, which is clever. That was theoretical, but Stephanie Hobson, who is a developer at Zing.com, like X-I-N-G, really did that, and they found out that their sites were being printed like 10,000 times a month and stuff. I'll throw some links to it in there. But she's, you know, makes a big case for why print style sheets are very important and how it's a little bit more complicated than just hitting Command P and then saying print to screen and looking at the little fake PDF. She says there's problems with doing it that way and stuff. Anyway, a little interesting follow up. Yeah. What do you got, Dave? Can we?
One thing this week I was interested in, and I'm glad Gina's on the show because stuff, Gina, that you're doing, you've like proposed kind of, you have some talk going around where you kind of propose like CSS or SAS architecture and stuff like that. This talk from Andy Hume, who used to work at ClearLeft out in the UK, but he has this talk at South By called CSS for Grownups, and it's up on the South By site. And then he has some slides on Speaker Deck, but it's called CSS for Grownups, but it's pretty awesome. I just love the idea that, like, okay, we've written CSS for a while now. Let's do it like adults. So I absolutely love the talk. I don't know if either of you got to catch it or cruise through the slides, but
no, I haven't had the chance to check that out yet. I'll have to check that out.
There's probably a lot of like congruencies between what you and Andy are saying, but it's really it's good. What's an example of a
best practice that you wouldn't normally think of is a?
Well, he gets into modularization and, you know, not being over specific and stuff like that. Talks about how preprocessors can help us do this better because we're not repeating ourselves. The classic like Facebook had 261 declarations of their Facebook blue or something like that.
Right.
That example's thrown out. It's cool. He gets into kind of, you know, just how he does it. And that's interesting to see. I think I'm just a fan of, and that's why, Gina, I love your slides, is just seeing how other people architect CSS, and especially on large scale things. That's fascinating and awesome to me.
What how would you describe your approach? Do you call it modular or do you, I don't know.
That's kind of the way I've been thinking of it. Even before I was even, you know, experimenting with SAS, I was trying to take a modular approach, thinking of things in terms of like little pieces that can be dropped where they need to be dropped without like thinking so much about the location of those pieces, but rather what those pieces do. You know, that could be an element or a widget or whatever. So, and then when I started embracing SAS, I realized those definitely go hand in hand.
So, right. So that kind of leans on class names more, doesn't it? Would you say that's right?
It depends. Before I got into SAS, like, you know, it was very likely you might have like a bunch of different classes on one element. But with SAS using extend, I can avoid some of that. So
right on.
It just depends on what it is.
Yeah, I suppose it is a little hard to talk super vaguely about, especially large projects. So anyway, good link. Thanks, Dave. Well, we should everybody check that CSS for Grownups. Awesome title too. Okay. A few more things. We're gonna do. Do you have like a flame sound, Dave, or maybe like
I have some hot drama for you.
A lot of this just went down today. So this is live today. There's the Mark Pilgrim, who is wrote a dive into HTML5 and other dive into stuff. Used to be Dive Into Mark on Twitter, and anyway, kind of disappeared from the internet at one point. Vanished. It hasn't been back. So Dave, you want to intro what the drama was regarding Dave?
Okay, so somebody files a request on the GitHub repo because Mark disappeared, and then some people had to like clone this repo to build out another version of it.
The book,
which is a website book thing. And so somebody files a request. It's an innocent request. He says that there should not be curse words on a public website, which I totally understand you don't want to just read filth, florin, filth on your websites. You know, you're trying to learn HTML5 and you have to, you know, maybe you don't want all the colorful language. I totally understand that, but it gets into this idea of like, do you just rewrite what happens? And since this book is on GitHub, what happened is Jonathan Neal went through and I guess, I don't know if he did it all by himself, but he basically replaced all the cuss words and pushed it through because he was on the repo. So it just begs the question, like, was that an appropriate thing to do? And it may be reverted. I'm not sure where it's at now. That's bad reporting on my behalf, but it's an interesting situation. It's hot drama.
The comments, and it was kind of like it may turn into a revert war, even though they're hoping that it doesn't. And it's Jonathan Neal is the name of the guy who was doing it, and he's trying to be very reasonable and trying to talk people out of it. And of course, there's a crap load of comments that are just like, very emotional responses to this. Little conversation going on that's rational talking about it. Although I gotta say, that was part of Mark's personality. Did you ever meet Mark, Gina, or before he disappeared?
No, I never got to meet him.
Yeah, I haven't either. But I heard that it's just kind of part of his personality and his writing style, certainly. And it's not like he just does it to be cool or to. I don't even know, or just too much, people that just swear habitually. He used it in lightly, and he used it for serious effect, I think. And to just take somebody's book that they wrote, it's not like he accidentally swore in this book. He wrote it. And then to take that and just, he's gone from the internet now. Let's take this book and remove all the swearing from it. I think it's ridiculous, but that's just my opinion.
I kind of agree with some of the comments where it's like, just fork it and do it. Like, I'm not going to fight whether it was, good to edit it or not, but it's like, that's what GitHub's made for. Just fork it and do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be he for sure will do that, but like, this is like the official fork, or I don't even know,
Yeah. You
should not do it on the official fork.
Could have done a no cussing branch.
We will follow up on this next week because it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I have a feeling that Jonathan is going to lose this one because people are going to be mad about it. I don't know.
People who cuss always tend to – never mind. I was going to cuss, so I'm not going to.
Yeah, I don't do it. When I talk, I never do it, or I do it. And it's just because I don't – it seems so like you're trying to be cool.
Right. It's interesting. What a wonderful world we live in where hot drama happens all the time. The only other bit of hot drama I want to mention, there's so much hot drama, but the only other one I want to talk about today is Mozilla announced that they are going to be adopting the H.264 format. So, too bad for them. They lost that battle. And everyone.
Isn't that good for us?
I love it. I'm so. Oh, it just I love means it.
That we don't have to make OGG anymore, right?
Yeah,
What does it mean?
WebM. So basically, you had to do a video on the internet with HTML5. You had to do an H.264, like a .mp4, and a WebM and an Ogg Vorbis if you wanted to support Firefox, old Firefox. So, like, nightmare. I mean, you're basically replicating video over and over and over. It's a problem. It's frustrated me a lot in the past. So I've worked.
Are
on
we
a few
down
video
to the
sites.
Point where, like, let's say the browser landscape was the most recent version of every single browser? Are we down to the point where it's just H.264? Or is there still two?
Opera is the only holdout. It looks like, and Opera Mobile. So
two formats, and which is Opera's format?
They use WebM and Vorbis. Any open format. Opera is super open. Which is admirable. I love that. I think it's beautiful. But it's like, I don't, I didn't buy an Ogg Vorbis player from Best Buy and I just hang out and listen to Oggs, You listen to MP3s, Anyway, I'm just a bitter Bradford on that subject. But
Here's a relevant link, vid.ly. If you do video stuff, apparently that's a little free. You can convert one for free, but otherwise it's a paid thing. You just it's one of those services where you just give them the video and they give it to you in a zillion formats. So you can, It's kind of like convert, that thing we use to make our MP3s into the other weird forms, but video is more expensive because it's more bandwidth. So anyway, apparently, and they host it for you. I don't know. I used it the other day and I thought that was awesome. So Fiddly.
Cool. Work. Cool. Well, let's get into listener submitted. The reason why we get together is listener submitted questions, by listeners like you, listener. So Chris, do you want to start this off?
Yeah. Weimar Whitby. I am curious to your guys' opinion on Google Plus's source code. It seems almost completely generated programmatically, I would guess, by Google's own web toolkit. Is generating non-semantic HTML a good idea? Chris, you had a screencast a while back all about writing semantic HTML. I know that the minimization and compression is all the rage nowadays, but is that going too far? I also remember that people used to dislike code produced by tools like Dreamweaver. Is it just better to write HTML by hand? This is interesting. So I think if you viewed source or started digging in the web inspector to Google Plus's source code, you find just a crap load of divs, and the divs have class names like A, B, and then there's one within that that's like C. So I don't know. What do you think about that, Gina? Have you ever looked at some weird stuff like that?
I haven't looked at Google Plus's source code, but, when it comes to my own personal work, I avoid abbreviating so much so that no one knows what anything is.
Yeah. I'm sure. I wonder what their reasons are. What could you speculate?
It seems like it's got to be an optimization thing, but I don't know. It could just be totally generated.
Yeah. Just because a one character class name is shorter, so that's better than a three character class name, because it's just all the less bandwidth to shoot across the wires, I suppose.
Have you seen their Google Plus button that you embed on your website? It's a G tag, it's a G colon plus or something like that, completely non-semantic HTML.
Oh, like the Google Plus button, the copy and paste code that they give you, has a G element in it, which is not even a real element, which is pretty bizarre. Yeah, you can just change it to a span if you want. It doesn't even matter. That's weird that they did that, though. I don't get it. Where does that, what would they benefit from being more semantic with their markup in there, or does it just absolutely not matter? Or
are they trying to boost their Google rankings?
Every site I do, I try to be a little semantic with it, unless it's to the point of, the modular stuff like we were just talking about. I don't know. That stuff relates to semantics in a weird way. Do you worry about using semantic class names, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. I definitely want my class names to be descriptive enough that people know what it is. Of course, avoiding presentational stuff like left or right or anything like that, but I feel like class names are a form of documentation in themselves, and if it's something as a shopping cart, then it should be called a shopping cart, and then when someone works on it and they see it's a shopping cart, that there's no question as to what the purpose of that class is for.
Right. So let's say the example we talked about was Facebook Blue or whatever, and how it's declared in a million places. In order to avoid it being declared in a million places, you might have a class name that deals specifically with coloring, and you might be color brand or something like that. Would that be something you would do, or would you just use the class name Blue, or would you try to avoid that?
I usually avoid class or. In my case, I'm probably doing a variable since I'm using SAS. Right. I try to avoid names that could change or are just referring to a color. If it's about brand, I might call it brand. I rarely have to create a class specifically just for a color. Maybe there's some text that's red because it's an error, but then in that case, I would just call it error.
Right. I wonder if have you ever played with so we're talking about CSS preprocessors a lot. I bet that those are the most commonly in use. But have you ever used HAML or SLIM or JADE?
Yeah, I used HAML when I was at Engine Yard. Mm-hmm. I think the stuff I've been looking at here at Do seems to be a little bit of a mix of markup styles, but my most projects I've worked on have just been ERB or plain old HTML.
The reason I brought it up is I was like, can you use variables as class names? So you could have like A, and A stands for, you know, you have like a key, and that stands for some kind of something that means something more semantic to you. So in when you're looking at the markup, it looks like, you know, a semantic class name, but when it gets output, it's just class A. I don't know. I've never.
I've never tried anything like that.
Yeah, I mean that's some weird micro-optimization stuff, but I wonder if that's. I don't know. It was the original Weimar's question is about Google Plus's source code, and I just it's hard to. I don't want to just like skewer Google, be like, no, their approach is definitely bad, because I'm sure they have their reasons for it, and they certainly write websites that are fast. But I would say they would benefit from more semantics. I guess I don't know. I just don't. I don't have the perfect answer for you, Weimar. Let's move on.
Moving on. So the next question is a call-in question, my favorite kind of question. From who's this from? It's from Brian Miller. And let's listen, shall we? I think this is it. Here.
Hey, guys. My name's Brian. First, I just want to thank you for the show. It's great. My question is around code handoff between a front-end developer and a back-end developer. I'm interested to hear how you guys have handled that in the past. Obviously, a front-end developer has a lot of experience with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, whereas your back-end developer may be more familiar with PHP, database integration, and in my case, an MVC framework. So I'm curious how a front-end developer may be able to reuse your applications, libraries, and style sheets, maybe through source control, when they may not be familiar with the inner workings of your application when it's in PHP and specifically an MVC framework. So just interested to hear how you guys have handled that. Thanks.
I got to just hand that off to Gina. Did you get the gist of it?
I think so. So I'm a big fan of pairing, which is something we did at Engine Yard. There was no handoff because we would oftentimes just work side by side. I would be sitting next to an engineer. I'd be working on front-end code while he or she was working on back-end code. And it just seemed a lot more efficient that way. Of course, not every work environment is like that. A lot of people, kind of have that more traditional style of like write some HTML, hand it off to a developer, they build it. But I just kind of like working in an app alongside developers. Another big thing I'm into is style guides, like UI libraries. And so oftentimes if I have everything documented in there, it's possible there's no handoff necessary. They can just kind of look right and see like what the different widgets or pieces that they need.
Oh, that's pretty powerful, right? They don't even kind of need a front end guy, because if the back end guy has a little bit of front end knowledge, which is not that hard, right? It's just a little HTML, and then you have documented, well, you use this HTML and you load up this CSS file. Maybe they can work on the app without even needing a specific front end person.
Yeah, and then if there's something that's not been documented and they need me, I'm happy to, do what I need to do. But then I know to throw that in the documentation so that I can let them work more efficiently and faster.
Right. So it's nice that if you I think that's a big deal that the people that work on your style guide, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, are the people that you both use it and create it. I've been in some weird positions where I'm like, okay, you make our style guides, and I do, and then, but I'm not the in the trenches developer, so I'm not sure if it's meeting their needs exactly. And I'd rather this guide be like a living document that we can update to their needs, Anyway, that's a random aside. So Brian's question was about handing off between front end or back end and front end, and Gina was kind of saying, well, there is no, maybe in an ideal world there is no handoff. You kind of work together, or if there does need to be a handoff, that everything is nice and well documented. That's pretty great. I totally agree with that. Have you ever dealt with handoffy situations, Dave?
Oh yeah, we do. We've done a lot of handoff stuff at Paravel in the last year-ish or so. And really, I think it's sort of like what Gina is describing, but except we're not in the same room because we like give it to another company and they take it. But then at some point you have a review process where they come back and you say, oh, let's work on this and fix this, or this is, I need styles for this. Let me show you what I have, you know? Yeah, I guess like back end guys should create a good. It's tough.
I know what you mean though.
It's like back end guys can make code. They output HTML. And front end guys should be able to do HTML. Sometimes they're just designers, but
that's a different topic. How do you hand off from Photoshop to another front end person, which is interesting too. But this was kind of front to back. One thing we did at Wufoo was design driven development, which is there'll be a bit of a mock up already in HTML and CSS, and you kind of hand it off the other direction. You hand it from you're like, here's what I need, back end guy, and here's how I want it to look. Could you fill in what I've just filled in with static HTML with your magical back end stuff? That can kind of work too.
I've done a little bit of that as well. Just mock up straight in HTML.
Yeah, flip the switch. I think the strength of that is that I think front end people, in general, this is too big of a generalization, but maybe if you're really a designer and you think about UX and you're a how it works kind of guy, maybe you're more suited to be the design how you want it to work. Not let a back end guy tell you what he's going to give you and then you just make it pretty or whatever. You're like, I want to design how I want it to work, and then back end guy, please make the magic happen. Back end guys can be good at UX too, so I didn't want to generalize.
Another thing that helps in my experience with both like WordPress or an MVC framework is a naked theme, like developing a totally stripped down one that the designer can play with. That helps. I mean, yeah, I always start like naked with it, as stripped down as possible on any sort of like WordPress stuff or whatever. Like,
yeah. And then in that case, your back end guy is a CMS.
Yeah. It's 150 people over at Automatic, or I don't know how many people.
Mike Apicaro asks, Twitter Bootstrap 2.0 uses the I element for inserting icons from a sprite. I love this implementation, but some would argue that using the I element is not semantically correct. I'm wondering if you've seen this usage elsewhere and what your thoughts are on the semantics of using an I versus a span or some other element. Mike, I would say, I don't know. That's a tough one to really care that much about, but I would say that the I element inherits the browser style of italic. In a lot of icon fonts, you don't want the browser making your font italic, so you will have to reset it in your CSS to not be italic, or as a span, you wouldn't have to worry about that. But I would just, I wouldn't
think you. The way I see it is an I element is no more or less semantic than a span element. The only purpose it serves is to add a styling to your text. Like, let's say there's no emphasis to it, but you just need to italicize. Maybe it's because it's, you know, you're using a word that's in another language. I'm sorry?
No, go on.
And so, like, in a way, like, you're just needing it for styling purposes anyway. I don't see what the problem is. It'd be different if you were using an M element, because then you're adding emphasis.
Right. So
I love that. That is the best explanation I've ever heard of that. That was really good. Thank you. I've been like waffling on whether or not, using an I, like an empty I element, is that just like, am I taking a dump on my markup, or am I just like filling it with, you know, empty divs, but, or empty I's, but that makes sense. It's for styling. That's why it was invented. So,
good.
And then I pretend that I means icon. That's what I pretend.
Oh, that's even better. I is for icon. I remember looking at, I did a view, back in the day, John Hicks's website had a border that went all the way around, like 10 pixel border that just went all the way around the browser window on the edges. And then I, if you viewed source and looked at it, it was four I elements at the end. And then he left a comment that was like, I know this isn't semantic, but I just pick eyes because it's small or whatever. And I always remembered that. I thought that was like kind of cute or whatever. Like, I don't care. You know, like we can argue semantics is like in content, but sometimes you just need an element to chuck some style on. I is perfectly acceptable, folks. What should we do? I feel like it's been a while here. We run 30 some minutes already here. So I kind of want to do one of our sponsor things. This is, week 4 of 4 for our sponsor Hover. Hopefully we can convince them to come back as a sponsor.
Come back, wait. Hover.
Yay, Hover. So hover.com/shoptalk, go there and it'll redirect you to Shop Talk and it'll give you this cool little message that's like 10% off your order. Anything that you buy from Hover, which is domain names primarily. So if you want to buy a domain name, you can do it from them. It's one of the like cleanest, nicest, simplest, best customer support places you can buy. We talked about some stuff in previous weeks, how they don't try to cross-sell you so much or whatever. This week's message is outstanding customer support. They have a no-wait phone policy at Hover. You call them up on their number and it rings a few times and a human being answers the phone and talks to you. So really fast phone policy. And they'll even help you answer problems that don't have to do with their service. You guys ever watch Parks and Recreation? I love that show.
Yeah.
Anyway, they always have like town meetings and people come to the town meeting and they like yell at the people in the front and they're like, this lady's like, I found a sandwich in the park and I ate it and it didn't have mayonnaise on it. Anyway, like if you called up Hover and told them that, they would help you with some mayonnaise, I bet.
Anyway, so are you kidding me? If I call them, I will talk to a human being and
we
not
try
a series of robots.
We should almost do it right now and see if we get somebody. Let's not, though. It's going to derail us. This
derail.
Next is for Gina specifically. Let's have it from Kevin D.
Hey, this is Kevin Davis over in Salt Lake City, Utah. I've got a question for Gina. I was one of those people that kind of learned web design backwards, and I actually started out in HTML and CSS and have always kind of designed in the browser, and that's always kind of been the way I felt comfortable doing things. But lately I've been trying to get more into, you know, the Adobe tools like Photoshop and Illustrator and going about things that way. And I first wanted to know what you prefer, if you design in the browser or if you use one of the imaging tools, and also which one do you prefer? Because I'm kind of looking to see which one to kind of put my time into learning. Are you an Illustrator person or Photoshop or both? And I'd really like to hear what you think about that. Thanks for taking my question, guys.
Cool. Well, I definitely prefer designing in the browser because that's going to be the most accurate depiction of what you're going to get. However, you know, not everything can be done in the browser at this point. So I do use Photoshop, you know, for maybe there's like a background texture or something that I need to create. If I'm designing for the iPhone, I'm not at the level yet that I've been able to build my own interfaces. So I often will mock that in Photoshop. And then from there, you know, hand it off in this case for someone to build it. That's not my ideal situation. And so I am, you know, trying to fix that and learn that. I've used Illustrator simply for vectors and print, and I actually love it for that. I love Photoshop for making digital art pieces, occasional UI pieces, but when it comes to designing or prototyping for the web, I'm all about designing in the browser.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a popular thing. And certainly there's some time-saving stuff there too, right? Like when you're done then and everybody likes it, you're like, you're done, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do the whole full comp in Photoshop. and then build it, but it's just so much faster. You can move entire pieces of elements so much faster with code than you can with layer groups and things.
Yeah, right on. And text, right? Doesn't anybody find it just incredibly bizarre that text looks better in these free web browsers than it does in a really expensive program for editing graphics? Why?
Exactly.
Why? Somebody could explain it to me. I'm sure it has to do with sizing and I don't even know. Science. I have no idea. There's definitely some science involved. That's cool. Have you ever done the fireworks thing or tried it? Or
I've definitely tried it. I guess because I started in Photoshop, it's really difficult for me to get too far into it without just jumping back over into Photoshop.
Right.
But I know.
Right there with you.
I definitely understand why people love it, and I wish I was good at it, but. You know, like the image optimization is apparently way better than Photoshop, but I just know Photoshop. So.
Yeah, it totally is. And like the vector stuff, the vector tools are better and easier and more obvious, I think. And the pixel snapping type of stuff is better and less weird. There's so many like good things, but I keep like trying it a little bit and I'm just being like, but I need to put a drop shadow on it. I don't know how to do it. Or some, it's just some dumb little thing will get me to switch back over. So Kevin D, that's Gina and our answers on it. Design the browser, or if you got to, for iPhone-y stuff, because it is hard. There is no interface builder is a little weird for iPhone. I definitely haven't done a lot of mobile design, but that stuff is, it's not as intuitive as Photoshop certainly. And it's definitely not as easy as just writing a little markup. Hopefully that answers your questions okay. We got one from Seth, who I believe is calling me out.
Uh-oh. My name is Seth, and I wondered why you're not actively trying to improve your knowledge of the terminal, because it's clear that it would be useful for you.
Boom. Call, shot called out. Boom. I love it.
I've just mentioned it in the past that I it's not even true that I actively avoid it. I'm in the terminal every day. I'm just not very good at it, and I learn a few commands, and I stick to my commands. I don't know. He's calling me out because he thinks – and he's right. It's like, hey, we write code all day long, right? Like, why can you just get over yourself and start learning the terminal too? And I should say that I'm not like afraid of it. I just prefer most things. Like I use SAS all day long, right? I don't want to go into the terminal, CD to where my thing is and go SAS watch and then dash dash and then the stupid formats and all that stuff. And then every time I restart my computer, I have to open it up and do it again. I would rather use something like Live Reload or CodeKit that just automatically starts when I turn my computer. It's automatically watching those directories for changes. It's like I prefer UIs. That's mostly what I'm trying to say. How often do you use the terminal, Gina? Are you like a terminal hero?
Oh, God, no. I've had to use it. Like, I started having to use it when I was at Apple. They were using SVN, so I had to learn SVN commands. And then the next gig after that was Git. And so, I've been using terminal just for, like, pulling and pushing. And that was about it until, you know, at EngineYard, I learned how to rebase and all that stuff. But it depends. For most things, yeah, like for SAS, I use an app. I use I actually have been using Scout. I haven't tried Live Reload or the other one you mentioned.
I've never even heard of that.
Googling yeah, it's just like a little app that just like, you know, you tell the directory where your files are and then it just watches. But for pulling and pushing and things like that, I actually do find it's faster to type it than it is to, pull up some UI app for it. So it's just
really,
yeah, because like I'm not to brag of myself, but I'm a pretty fast typer, and the time it would take me to just type it versus pulling up an app is, you know, worth just having terminal open. But that's like the extent of it. That's like as much as I do.
What that stuff? I mean, I'm not going to like test you, but let's say you had to, somebody's like, oh, hey, could you, clean up and commit everything you got and then come over to the, to branch to, you know, whatever, some name of some other branch on this thing. And then, I don't know, just that's it. Could you like commit all your stuff and switch to a new branch in like 10 seconds or less? that was weird. But that's the type of stuff that gets weird, you know? I don't know. Everybody in the chat room is like tower or plus one. And I totally agree. I use a GUI for that because I don't even know how to switch branches from that. So yeah, you called me out, dude.
I can switch branches and create new ones, but if there's like a huge like merge issue, then it gets pretty tricky. And then I open up open diff or whatever to visually see it.
That's what I was going to ask you. That's the hardest part, is when there's a merge conflict that the command line gives you. There is a way to diff from the command line, but it looks so gnarly, and it's so nice in Tower. It just shows you which files are problematic. You go through each one, and you can resolve with yours or resolve with them or resolve it manually. Anyway, I envy you. You're better at it than me, and I'm sorry, Seth. I'm going to take your criticism and get better at it.
Do we have an absolute position? Do front end coders need to know, like, have knowledge and command of the command line?
No.
I don't think they absolutely need to, but they would be a little faster if they did, or maybe a lot faster.
The day you sign up for GitHub, you have to do some fancy stuff. I'm sure you guys remember that day, right? You have to, like, make a SSH key in some weird hidden directory, and you have to like then copy it with some weird command and post it over to you, right? Like, that's the only real way to create an SSH key is through the terminal, right? So you kind of have to use it at some point for that, unless you use the GitHub for Mac, you know, that, and that's the type of stuff that will keep a designer away from GitHub, is those weird moments. And that's why I think like all these GUI tools are so awesome, like Tower. And for GitHub for Mac, you don't even have to. It even deals with that crappy step for you. You just put in your GitHub credentials, and you're pulling and pushing and stuff without even that weird SSH key step. Should I take that to a weird place?
No, you're fine. You're perfect. Thanks. The chat room is saying, I think the summary is that you should. You don't need to. You should. All right. Well, okay. Next question is from Mark Senf.
This is long. Are you prepared for this, or how are we going to do this?
I'll get my Shakespearean prose voice on. No, it's long, but here we go. Questions about preprocessors, boilerplates, bootstraps, and all those things that make it easier for us developers. Is there a risk that we let these tools do too much and that we lose our skills here and there? Obviously, when a repetitive task is automated, that's great. But I'm worried about a situation where you type the following specific syntax and it's transformed and changed into proper CSS. What if I would get used to using SAS and lose track of CSS? Is it possible to score an A+ on a SAS test, but then only score B- on CSS only test? That's a good question.
That is a good question.
Okay. If I were a SAS guru and I moved jobs where SAS was not an option, I'm told, just do straight actual CSS. Then what? Am I hosed? Is this the same as asking a Dreamweaver HOT metal front page expert about HTML CSS? That's another good question. All right.
Leave it there because that's.
Okay. Yeah. We have second part. We have chapter two.
So later. Here it is. This is for Gina. Are you worried that you write so much SAS that someday you're going to forget about how to actually write CSS?
No, not at all. Because I use the SCSS syntax for my personal work. And, you know, at some places I've had to use the original SAS syntax, but. I don't find that I forget how to write CSS. I just find that it enables me to write better CSS. And I mean, I could see if maybe you were using some frameworks or, you know, something like Compass where you're writing includes instead of writing out your, you know, all your prefixes and things, you might forget what those are, but maybe that's a good thing. I'm just not worried about that. I don't see it the same as like, a front page editor compared to writing traditional HTML. I see it more like you're still writing CSS. You just have a layer of awesomeness on top of it.
I totally agree. I do sort of think, though, that all three of us in this room come from a level of pre-SAS. You know, like we were good at CSS before SAS came along, and now we can sprinkle on SAS and make us even more better. But maybe these days, if you're coming on the scene on day one and you use SAS, you learned SAS before you even learned CSS, that you are perhaps a little bit in danger of stuff.
Possibly, maybe. But I kind of see that SAS is where CSS is headed towards. So okay. I'm not really finding that to be a problem. And if you are going from an environment where you learn SAS and now you're in an environment where you have to write CSS, you can still write SAS because you don't have to run it on an app. And I think that's the misconception a lot of people have. You can run it locally on your machine and compile it, and that's what you put in your app.
Yeah, that's true. If you're not on a team, you know.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
But your first version could still be just CSS, like your version one. Just do SAS, crunch it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The day that you have to leave SAS behind is not a very hard day, because you just throw away your SAS files and or make sure that your last compile you have it set on the pretty print way or whatever. So, you know what I mean? If you left all your stuff compressed, which I think that's weird. Does anybody set their SAS to any other setting than super duper mega compressed? I just don't see there any reason to.
Sometimes when I'm in development, I might switch it over to the verbose mode just so I can see line numbers and quickly find where the CSS is coming from. But yeah, for most everything else, it's always set to the super duper compressed version.
Yeah.
I use super duper compressed so that when I open it, I go, oh no, this is not the file I'm supposed to be in. Because
that's great. That's
so I don't accidentally start editing the CSS.
I like Mark's question on the, is it possible to score an A+ on a SAS test, but then score a B- on a CSS only test? Yeah, I mean, sure, anything's possible, but I would hope that most people kind of are just as good at CSS as they are. It's kind of like the same question, should you learn jQuery first or should you learn native JavaScript? And that's going to be a never-ending battle till the end of time, because it just will.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's see the second part.
Okay. The second part of his question is like, is it the right time to pick a preprocessor right now? For example, 2 years ago, if he had chosen between jQuery and MooTools, he might have chosen MooTools, but he was glad he chose jQuery. Because if he had made a different choice, it would be kind of, you know, he'd be behind because jQuery is kind of the leader right now.
Do you think it? I just don't. They're not that. Even jQuery and MooTools aren't that different. Yes, they're different, but they're all the concepts are the same. And CSS is much easier than JavaScript. CSS is not that difficult of a thing to learn. And so let's say you had to switch to less tomorrow, but all you knew was SAS, it would not take you that long.
I agree. I actually started out with less, and that was a project I was working on. And then, you know, for another company, we switched over to SAS, and it did not take long at all to switch. And if you look at the different ones side by side, like there's not a whole lot different in terms of like mix-ins and variables. It just might be slightly written differently.
Right. Yeah, it's just a little bit different syntax and, you know, a little more bugs on one or the other and a little, you know, or I don't know. Just it's mostly trivial. All right. So let's just kick it off. And I do want to tell the audience right now, I'm sure some people are bored to death of preprocessor talk. I enjoy talking about it, but we will not do this on every single episode. I just, you know. I know some people just don't care, but you know what? Gina is redesigning the SAS website, and we all use SAS, and we're going to talk about SAS on this episode because it's awesome. Tony Sirois asks, when writing SAS with or without Compass, When do you use extend and when do you use a mix-in? What situation is appropriate for either, or is this a personal style issue? It seems like mix-in is more flexible but could lead to larger CSS files. Maybe I'm thinking about this wrong, but I tend to overthink and confuse myself. Let's have it.
So when I first started out, I was just using mix-ins. I didn't even know extend existed. That made my CSS massive, absolutely massive. And so I started, I learned about extend and started using extend for things like clearfix or maybe have a set of styles that's specifically for hiding text for image replacement, making that into an extend. And it cleaned up a lot of my code.
Can you explain the difference between the two of them?
Oh, yeah, sure. So with a mix-in, let's say you create a stack of rules that's a mix-in for making a box look like a pop-up or something like that. And then maybe there are a few other elements throughout your CSS that have similar rules. You can extract that into a mix-in and reuse that. But the way mix-in would work is it would duplicate those rules again each time you call upon that mix-in. With extend, you create a class and you... If you have something that needs to use the same styles as another class that you've created, you can extend it. And what it'll do is put those together as a comma delimited set of rules. Selectors. So instead of duplicating all those rules, it just tacks it on and they share the rules. So that cleans up your code. So I tend to always default to extend now to clean things up. However, there are certain things mix-ins are good for, like you can pass arguments through it. So maybe you have a rounded box that has a shadow on it that's, you know, black. Right. And then in another case, you want to have all those same styles, but you want to pass in green instead of black. Mix-ins are fantastic for those. But sometimes what I'll do is then include those mix-ins in extend classes so that it's like another layer of abstraction, but it helps kind of keep things clean. And there is some new stuff coming out. Last I saw that like will allow you to create silent extend classes. So like let's say you create a class of clearfix, but you don't ever use that in your markup. You can make that silent. So that doesn't actually output into your CSS, just the classes that use it.
That are used?
Yeah.
Wow. So can it reads your markup too?
No, it just you tell it that it's a silent class, and so it you can extend upon that class, but that class in particular won't output.
So okay. It's like a mix-in, but only invoked when necessary. Sort of,
yeah.
Okay, cool. I think I get it. I'm probably
that's fancy. I'm definitely
anyway.
At that point where I should be using more extends, and I kind of get it now, but I'm not. I haven't quite gotten to the point where I'm using them properly. But that's cool. I don't think Less has the concept of a extend, does it?
Last I checked, they don't.
Okay, and that's kind of a big deal because if you only use mix-ins for everything. You will get because it just spits that same chunk out over and over and over. It will be larger CSS files certainly. Whereas an extend just changes the selector; it just smushes the selectors together and has only one chunk of that CSS, which is certainly more efficient. But it depends. Like Gina said, extends can't take variables or whatever. You can't pass things to an extend. We should do we're getting up towards the end here, but it's making me sad. So I want to do one more sponsor quick because they're awesome. We should do this first next, guys. These guys are great. this is Alan and Steve from Less Everything. What they are trying to sponsor this time is Less Money, a conference about making your business more profitable, less stressful, being a better business owner. Check out the website at lessmoney.lesseverything.com. It's coming up June 7th, and it goes back-to-back with the front-end design conference, which I've spoken at. I know all three of us, I think, have spoken at that. That one in St. Pete? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's Dan Denny's thing. It runs back-to-back with that. I think this is first, maybe, or maybe after. I don't know, but it runs – if you wanted to go to Dan Denny's thing, the front end design conference. You could also go to this, lessmoney.lesseverything.com, June 7th in Tampa, Florida. Thanks, guys, for sponsoring the show. I wish somebody decides to go to this thing and then tells us that they decided to go to it because they heard it on the show. That would make me very happy. Let's do a last. Can we just do a last question? I think we're probably at that
point. Yeah, let's do one final one. Do you want to do this one from Milos?
Newfangled things. Let's see. Well, it's too late now. What if he's listening and now he skipped it? That would be rude.
Okay, here we go. Hello, Milos. You're on the line.
Hey, Chris. What's up, Dave? My name is Milos, and I'm a developer from Munich. I would love to hear your opinion on a topic that has been keeping me pretty busy over the last couple of months. So I've started web development through college somewhat 2.5 years ago and barely did anything else since. Some of the technologies I've learned and work with daily include HTML5, CSS3, responsive web design, JavaScript, PHP, and frameworks like jQuery, Dojo, and Zend. And I also feel pretty comfortable using these. The thing is, though, I am very curious about other languages, frameworks, and programming methodologies as well. Stuff like Node.js, Ruby on Rails, CoffeeScript, Backbone.js, WebGL, Django. I could literally continue like this for a while. So I would love to hear your take on learning new stuff, especially the one way that works best for you. Personally, I've tried reading books, watching tutorials, and working with the technology I'm trying to take in. But I don't feel like I've found the perfect, most productive workflow yet. So if there even is such a thing, I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's my question. Keep up the great work, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who's been enjoying Shop Talk a lot. Thank you.
Awesome question. So how do you guys learn all this new junk that comes out every single day?
There's a lot there. It sounds a little bit like, Milos, that you're trying to learn things I hate to say this, but are you learning these things for a reason? I feel like maybe that's how it happens for me, is that I need to use maybe you should have a little bit of an understanding of what is Backbone, what does it do generally, and then if you are working on something that needs something that is like that, then maybe dig into it. But I don't know if I would waste, but I don't know if I would spend time learning just like I'm going to sit down and learn Backbone.js this weekend, in and out, every detail, for no reason. You know, I don't know that you would never get anything done if you should learn about these newfangled things, and then as you need them, maybe dig into them. Or am I weird? I don't know. What if there's a new preprocessor tomorrow? Would we sit and learn it? Or
I just only have been able to learn things as I needed them, because I just would never have a life if I didn't learn everything. There's so much out there.
Yeah. And then he mentions workflow. I was like, what? Are you talking about your workflow of learning new things, or your workflow, just your general workflow? Because I think your general workflow will depend on whatever it is you're trying to build. How do you like that? Do you know what Backbone.js is, Dave? I don't even know what that is, really.
Backbone's like an MVC framework for JavaScript.
Yeah,
I think that's simplifying it, but
So if the day that comes out, like, do you just like become aware of what it is basically, or do you do more than that? Do you try and work with it a little bit?
So for me, when something like this comes out, if I'm interested in it, if it's something like, oh hey, I was just thinking about installing Node on my iPhone or something like that. You know, it's like, I'll try to hello world it and just get, find the easiest tutorial. Usually it's over at NetTuts, but, just find like the easiest tutorial and just hello world it and see if I like it, see if it's like intuitive to me, if it's something I would use. I think that's the easiest way to do that.
It kind of sounds like you enjoy that a little bit.
I do a lot of it. I'm a bit of a, mm-hmm. I'm a bit like Milos. An addict. I'm an information addict. And
there are meetings. Do you go to meetings?
Gosh darn it. People like me. But it's really the best kind of new technologies to pick up are the ones somebody's paying you to use. So that's what I would say is, like, if somebody's like, hey, I want to give you money in to build this thing, but it has to be on Backbone, you would say, yes, I love that. I want to do that. and that would be, yeah, that's the best way.
Backbone developer.
Yeah. And it, but if, like, you know, there's like competitors to Backbone and stuff like that. Like, we're using Backbone as an example here, but like, if a competitor comes out and you're like, oh, maybe this solves the problems I'm having with this, then crack it open, man. Crack it open.
Good. Okay, Miliosh. You already know so many things. Just keep it up. I think you're doing okay, as it is with all the fancy stuff you know. Okay, Gina, how can people give you money and be interested in see your work and
follow your life and musings?
How can people give me money? I don't know, send it to me. some of my work lately has been, not released yet. I am working, like I said, at Due. We're working on a new version of the iPhone app, and hopefully that'll be out pretty soon, but that's something I'm working on right now. Obviously, you can follow Team SAS Design if you're interested in keeping up with, our progress on that. We're still in the user research phase.
So that's going to be out next week, right? The whole finished design.
Yeah.
Just kidding. But I'm just excited.
I unfortunately don't have a whole lot of time to do like as many side projects these days as I used to, but I do still have Art and My Coffee up and running. You're welcome to check that out.
Cool. At Gina on Twitter, right? And
yeah,
Art and My Coffee. Do work together, Team SAS Design. Mm-hmm. Follow everything Gina does. It will be worth it for you, people of Shop Talk.
Yeah, well, thanks everyone for a wonderful episode. Thanks for everyone in the chat room who's tuning in and listening. Thanks to Reagan Ray, who helps us out with the broadcasting. And Chris, do you have a final thing to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.